This is Free Speech Radio News on June 20, 2003. From WBAI New York City, I'm Amma Bouadi. Hundreds rally outside the headquarters of the Baltimore Sun. As the talks between US and the European Union break down over GM food production, the Bush administration prepares to host an international ministerial on biotechnology, and Colin Powell heads to the Middle East to attend the World Economic Forum. But first, these headlines.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The arrest of an Ohio man who admitted to aiding al-Qaeda has resulted in a media frenzy. CBS News reports that Lyman Farris played his music loud. A Cleveland newspaper quotes neighbors as saying that Lyman let the grass in his yard grow too high. Since September 11th, character assassination in the press has taken place on many levels, from ordinary citizens to government officials. In a case just now surfacing, an American newspaper apologized to a British politician it accused of accepting millions of dollars from Saddam Hussein. Even after clearing his name, George Galloway has been suspended from the Labour Party for speaking out against the war in Iraq. Charlotte Parsons has more.
The Christian Science Monitor has admitted that a set of documents implicating George Galloway are probably fake. Papers dated from the early 90s showed Galloway received $10 million for promoting Iraqi interests. But tests show the documents were only a few months old. The suspended Labour Party minister has refused to accept the apology and is demanding to know who forged the papers. Halloway believes that he is the victim of a conspiracy and has called on Prime Minister Tony Blair to find out who's behind it. Meanwhile, a British newspaper has refused to retract similar allegations it made against the politician. The Daily Telegraph says it based its story on a different and authentic document. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Charlotte Parsons in London.
At least 5,500 Iraqi civilians have died since the U.S. invasion, according to IraqBodyCount.org. And as Ahmed Al-Rawi reports from Baghdad, there are other horrible post-war consequences for the people in Iraq.
Al-Tuwaitha is an area inflicted with nuclear radiation due to the looting which happened to the Iraqi nuclear site. All the blue uranium barrels were taken by the residents, who use them in their domestic lives. Some wash their clothes in them, a problem that greatly increased the spread of a strange disease among the children of the area. Among the symptoms is the appearance of marks and deformities in different parts of the body. The American forces recovered 100 blue barrels from the people in return to $3 for a barrel. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ahmed Arawi from Baghdad.
After meetings with Bush administration officials, Turkey has agreed to send troops into Iraq. Ezgi Sartaj reports from Ankara.
The U.S. wants Turkish troops to operate under Polish forces in southern Iraq. Although Turkey is hesitant to operate under another country's forces, U.S. officials made a proposal that was not subject to bargain. Up to 5,000 Turkish soldiers may soon move to Iraq. The tension between the two countries started 4 months ago when the Turkish parliament refused to permit U.S. troops to use Turkish soil in the invasion of Iraq, a decision which had the support of Turkish people. Now U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell has invited Turkish Foreign Minister Abdullah Gül to the World Economic Forum in Jordan. This is seen as strengthening of the ties between the two countries. However, it seems like the process will not be smooth. Many here are concerned that the more Turkey sacrifices, the more the U.S. will demand. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ezgi Sertaş from Ankara, Turkey.
After the White House edited significant portions of the Environmental Protection Agency's review of environmental problems since 2001, the EPA decided to delete an entire section of the report. Wendy Campbell reports from Washington.
A section describing the risks of rising global temperatures has been completely omitted from the forthcoming EPA report after the Bush administration added recommendations and selectively filtered criticism. Among these edited facts was a 1999 study showing the dramatic rise of temperatures worldwide. The 1999 conclusion was replaced by a study funded by an oil interest group questioning the effects of fossil fuels on global warming. The EPA is reluctant to take responsibility for the White House's revisions. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Wendy Campbell.
The Justice Department banned an annual Gay Pride event in the Great Hall of the department's headquarters. James Cullum reports from Washington.
Attorney General Ashcroft finally allowed the event to take place, but said that if gay DOJ employees wanted to celebrate in the department's Great Hall of Justice, they would have to fund the event themselves. DOJ Gay Pride has held the celebration without a fee in the past and refused Ashcroft. Democratic Senator Frank Lautenberg offered to have the program take place in a Senate office building. Ashcroft said that since the president did not make a proclamation legitimizing Gay Pride Month, that employees would not be able to exhibit their sexual preference at the workplace. DOJ Pride members say that the gay and lesbian employees will not pay a toll to access the Great Hall of Justice. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm James Cullum.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
Clashes between protesters and police have broken out in Thessaloniki, Greece, where the European Union summit is being held. 10,000 demonstrators were met by 5,000 police and tear gas. While inside, European leaders endorsed a new European Union constitution. Back in Jordan, global participants are flocking to take part in an extraordinary summit for the World Economic Forum on Saturday. High on the agenda, held for the second time in its history outside Davos, Switzerland, for the quartet members, the US, Russia, the UN and the EU, is the Middle East process and how it can be salvaged, as it has been battered by days of Israeli and Palestinian violence. Secretary of State Colin Powell, who today accused the Palestinian group Hamas of being, quote, the enemy of peace, is attending the high-profile meeting on Sunday and is also delivering a keynote speech at the World Economic Forum meeting. Ula Farawati takes a look into how the US is using what analysts term as economic pressure on Arab countries to carry out its policies, no matter how flawed, in the Middle East.
Away from the media hype surrounding the upcoming World Economic Forum meeting in Jordan Saturday, a meeting which also coincides with talks between US Secretary of State Colin Powell and Israeli and Palestinian leaders, has many in the Arab world feeling that the US is once again pressuring Arab countries into becoming enforcers for US policy. Many here in Jordan consider the World Economic Forum meeting and the main issue on its agenda, the US proposed American-Arab Free Trade Area, as a reward for Arab countries' cooperation, especially those countries like Jordan and Qatar that assisted US efforts to invade Iraq and are now main supporters for the US-backed peace roadmap. Arab Rentawi is a non-Jordanian columnist in the Jordanian daily Ad-Dustur.
The United States is used to using the tactic of punishment and reward in dealing with Arabs. About the letter that Secretary of State Colin Powell passed to Syrian President Bashar Assad in his visit to Damascus after the war on Iraq, Powell told Assad the American president is giving three options: the diplomatic option, the economic, and the military options, the three of which are all available for the U.S.
Political analyst Lamis Andoni, who specialized in Palestinian affairs, says Arab states are losing out by accepting the U.S.-backed roadmap, a plan many here deem flawed and favors Israel in return for economic benefits.
When Arab countries took part in one way or another in the war against Iraq, including Jordan, they were promised some compensation. So they now they are expecting the U.S. to deliver. Secondly, they want the Arab states now to increase normalization, with the rate of normalization with Israel. And there is a stagnation in the region, as well as all the region has suffered from the war and the aftermath, as well as in Jordan's case, what's happening in the West Bank and Gaza. So Jordan is in need of any support it can get.
And Donnie adds that the effect of this support for the war and then the problematic roadmap are negatively affecting the social fabric in Arab countries and are further widening the gap between a public who wants a just solution and the bureaucrats who want to please the U.S. Lawyer and economist Ghassan Mu'ammar agreed, saying that though economic benefits were used to persuade Jordan into becoming a U.S. ally in the Middle East, Amman has not benefited from the many economic agreements it signed with the U.S., including a free trade agreement and the so-called qualifying industrial zone agreements.
In fact, economically, Jordan so far has suffered. It didn't benefit at all from the lifting all kind of reservations that were imposed in the past era, okay? Jordan has suffered the consequences, actually, of liberalizing the system for a growing economy were negative, okay? A growing economy for a third world country such as Jordan, in fact, needs more reservations than what is being done. It's not a healthy symptom, actually, to open the system all of a sudden just for the sake of complying with the international rules that are imposed by the IMF and the World Bank.
Although Jordan's free trade agreements with the US included strict provisions to protect environmental and labor standards, Jordan, according to political analyst Muammar, has not enforced these provisions.
Environmental issues are still minor issues or minor symptoms compared to any European country.
Arabs from all walks of life are in a wait-and-see mode when it comes to U.S. promises of a just solution for the Palestinian crisis that has plagued Arab economies and social and political strata for more than half a century. If the U.S. fails to bridge the gap, this will yet become another stone on a wall of hatred built over years and years between Arabs and the U.S. In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati for Free Speech Radio News.
Hundreds of members of the Washington-Baltimore Newspaper Guild rallied outside the headquarters of the Baltimore Sun yesterday in protest of the paper's proposed new labor agreement. This is the first contract Sun employees have sought from the Tribune Company since the Chicago-based media conglomerate bought the daily newspaper from the Times Mirror Company 2 years ago. And as John Hamilton reports from Baltimore, many Sun employees feel their company is hoping to consolidate its media empire by squeezing concessions from its workers.
Union in, scabs out! Union in, scabs out!
Only 4 days remain until the expiration of a contract covering 650 Sun employees with the Washington-Baltimore Newspaper Guild. And according to Sun employee Connie Knox, managers have turned to other employees of the vast Tribune Company to keep a strike from stopping the presses.
We know that they have brought in employees from the Tribune papers in Florida and Connecticut, New York, and Chicago, and Los Angeles to train to do the jobs of people here.
In a nearly unanimous vote taken Tuesday night, the 650-member-strong Newspaper Guild voted to authorize a strike next week unless talks produce a new contract. On Monday, Guild reporters began a byline strike, and they've since refused to appear on WMAR-TV, a local ABC affiliate and partner of The Sun. Among the most contentious proposals the paper has put forward is a pay-for-performance plan. Employees would receive only a 2% raise over the next 4 years, with additional money being set aside by the company for managers to reward those employees deemed more productive.
Supervisors who see people's work day in and day out certainly know the people who are performing great, doing great work, and the people who are uninspired and not doing a great job.
Linda Giesen is director of marketing and communications for The Sun.
What the company is looking to do in terms of a high-performing culture is to make sure that everybody is incented through their salary, through the money that they get, through performance-based pay, to really give it the very best they can day in and day out.
But pay for performance and many of the Sun's other current proposals are roundly rejected by union members.
What's on the table now is garbage, and they need to understand it and get serious.
Lori Calderon is with the Washington-Baltimore Newspaper Guild and chief negotiator for the Sun contract.
What we've said to them in our experience has been, is that pay for performance does not motivate professionals to do better. Journalists are journalists because they want to work in the profession and excel at the investigation and the written word, not because they're going to get another $20 a week or $30 a week.
Business reporter Andrea Walker worries that pay for performance would force reporters into competition with one another in order to please managers.
The problem with the proposal is there's no criteria to how the supervisors would decide who that money would go to. So basically it's up to their discretion, and it could end up being subjective, and it could end up turning into a system of favoritism where whoever the boss is like, that's who gets the raises.
The union is also furious over a proposal that would allow Sun managers to outsource jobs and to shuffle workers into new positions, including lower-paying ones. Other concessions, like lower pensions, a reduction in the number of paid sick days, and increases in employee health costs, remain unresolved. Copy editor Wayne Countryman blames executives at the Tribune Company's Chicago headquarters.
Decision-making as far as even what goes into the newspapers being affected by the ideas in Chicago. Also, it seems to me the company's trying to scare up money to expand at the cost of those already in the chain.
Like many Sun employees, Countryman worries that unless Congress moves to reverse the FCC's recent decision to relax media ownership rules, media chains like the Tribune Company will continue to grow. That, he says, could mean fewer reporters covering more stories.
It could be very big in that the trend is going to be for corporations to try to own as many TV stations and the newspaper in a given market. That means there'll be fewer reporters covering meetings, fewer editors working on their stories. So not only does that mean that there'll be fewer jobs in the long run, but also fewer people covering the news, fewer viewpoints.
For its part, the Tribune Company welcomes recent changes at the FCC. The company says the changes will be a boon for listeners, readers, and viewers while enriching the content of the company's newspapers, television stations, and websites. But Linda Calderon disagrees.
You cannot have one corporate owner dominating the media in a city like Baltimore or anywhere else. That we need to have different voices, we need to have different opinions, and we need to not turn into some kind of clear channel model. And the Tribune is certainly interested in that.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm John Hamilton in Baltimore.
For 2 days, citizens of Benton Harbor, Michigan, took to the streets to protest the death of a young man, Terrence Shawn, who lost control of his motorcycle during a high-speed chase and died. Benton Harbor, Michigan, is over 90% black, but the officers in this case were white, prompting hundreds of citizens to protest. Richard Winslow, director of ACORN, spoke with Free Speech Radio News with regards to this situation.
It's not just a matter of having a few bad apples on the police force that somehow got corrupted. It's what was the atmosphere that allowed this kind of activity to take place in the first place?
What is it that you hope to achieve with all of this? I mean, where will you go from here?
Where do we go from here?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, we got to look at have a little bit of justice here in America, a little social justice for people. We got to raise the hope of people that they can have a better life. When people lose hope, then they turn to these as a way of just venting anger. Right now, what's happening is anger and frustration are being vented with maybe a hope that there will be some change in police practice. But it's not just police practice. It's the social fabric of America. We need to look at it and look back at some of the things and take back America and actually make this the kind of country that's going to be good for everybody.
Richard Winslow, director of ACORN, speaking with Free Speech Radio News earlier today. According to the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, of the 22 million refugees under their care, 18 million are women and children. And as events around the globe recognise this day as the third annual United Nations World Refugee Day, refugee organisations in New York gathered to celebrate the efforts of a young group of 12 refugees trying to educate their peers and the public about the refugee experience in the United States. From Pacifica Radio WBAI in New York City, Jackson Allers reports.
The 12 young refugees are part of a multimedia production called One Family, organized by the Global Action Project, a media art organization based in New York City. The project documents common experiences of war with refugees living in the United States. Aida Susic is a 16-year-old refugee who came into the United States 2 years ago from Bosnia.
When I came here, it was hard for me. I was feeling very lonely. I didn't have any friends. So I thought if I get involved in this program, maybe I could make some friends and it could help me to adjust to life here.
The documentary project was started in 2001 and originally it was meant to regenerate itself with new refugees coming into the United States the following year. But that's not what happened, says producer Raishma Razvi of the Global Action Project.
After 9/11, that was one of the first sort of immigration programs to just cease completely.
At the event, the 12 young refugees who came from war zones in countries like Bosnia, Serbia, Sierra Leone, and Burundi produced a public service announcement about the new U.S. immigration policy.
70,000 refugees were supposed to come to the United States.
But only 23,000 of us were allowed in due to September 11.
This is the biggest drop in 20 years.
Although the President and Congress determined the target quota for refugee admissions, Will Coley, a project coordinator for the American Friends Service Committee, says that didn't happen in 2002. Coley's organization was one of the sponsors of the event, and he says projects like the One Family documentary helped to draw attention to the over 40,000 refugees the United States didn't let in last year.
It's an important time in the world to be recognizing the unique experiences of refugees, particularly after September 11th. I mean, now that there's this global concern about security, refugees are being left out in the cold. And people aren't recognizing the fact that refugees don't have documentation. They don't have the means to have protection of a country.
And Bosnian refugee Aida Sosic admits she has reservations about the security culture keeping certain refugees out of the United States.
It was really important that they gave opportunity to some refugees to come here and start new life, get better opportunities. And now that not many people can come here, I think it's really bad.
The One Family documentary project will continue to document the lives of refugee children living in the United States. From New York City, I'm Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
Talks between the United States and the European Union over opening up Europe to genetically modified foods broke down in Geneva this week. Meanwhile, the Bush administration is hosting an international ministerial conference in Sacramento, California this weekend. The conference will touch upon many technology and agricultural issues, one of which includes the promotion of genetically engineered crops to developing countries. The conference will also serve to formulate a complaint by the United States and other countries to the World Trade Organization that the European Union's moratorium of genetically modified organisms is illegal. This is the first World Trade Organization-related meeting in North America since Seattle in 1999. It's predicted that thousands of demonstrators will protest the conference in Sacramento this weekend. They say genetically modified organisms have not been proven safe and that the conference is part of the Bush administration's agenda to promote the corporate takeover of the global food production. Mitch Jeserich has more from Sacramento.
Over 180 countries are sending ministers to Sacramento for an international conference on agriculture and science, sponsored by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The conference will be a platform to promote the use of bioengineered crops in the developing world. The idea is that a crop could be genetically altered to grow in abundance on barren lands, thus averting famine. Two of the largest GM food producers, Monsanto and DuPont, claim in their commercials, often seen on PBS, that they are helping to feed the world through innovative technology. But Luke Anderson, who is the author of the book Genetic Engineering, Food, and Our Environment, says just the opposite. He says there is enough food in the world to go around and that the real problem is distribution.
There are 30,000 people dying every day from hunger. That is true. But this is happening in a world which is producing enough food to feed 1.5 times the current population with an adequate nutritious diet. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to guess that there might be political reasons why people are hungry. And in fact, it is the economic policies being promoted, defended, and aggressively pursued by the United States government in meetings such as this one in Sacramento that are directly responsible for the deaths of these people every single day. A significant act of economic terrorism, I would suggest.
Anti-globalization protesters and organic food advocates began gathering in Sacramento this week. Through teach-ins, speak-outs, and planning sessions, the activists are readying themselves for several days of protests starting this weekend. Thousands are expected to protest the International Ministerial Conference. The cause? Stop the proliferation of genetically modified crops and other organisms. Lita Dieterich is one of the demonstration's organizers.
The reason that we're all here for this particular ministerial is to say no to corporate control of our global food system and no to the genetic engineering of food, which is going to irreversibly contaminate our global food supply. So I think that this resistance is building. It's been building over the last few years. It's what we saw, an incredible energy around that through the war on Iraq, and we're going to see that again this week.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture says GMO foods are safe to eat. Supporters say that millions of people eat them, and not a single person has gotten sick because of it. But Evan Paul of Environment California says that's a bad way to test for safety.
Because this genetically modified food is going into our food system so rampantly, a lot of times people are eating genetically modified organisms and not even aware of it. So people may be having allergenic effects in others and never connecting it to their food. If you're eating a tomato and it has a fish gene in it, you'd never suspect, if you're allergic to fish, that it's the tomato that caused an allergic reaction.
The Agricultural Conference will also ready its complaint to the World Trade Organization that the European Union's moratorium on GM foods is illegal. The EU moratorium demands that genetically modified foods be labeled, something the American agricultural industry, backed by the U.S. government, refuses to do, saying that fears are not based on scientific evidence. Civil disobedience demonstrations against the conference are planned to begin on Saturday and last through Wednesday. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Sacramento.
Today, the Pentagon issued what it called a, quote, serious terror threat in Nairobi, Kenya's capital city, prompting a closure of the U.S. embassy in the city. The Pentagon has focused its counter-terror activities in Kenya and other countries in the region. Whilst the U.S. concentrates its efforts on this activity, they've turned their backs consistently on another deadly front. Three-quarters of the world's gemmed diamonds come from Africa. Of these, about 5% come from regions involved in intense civil strife and conflict, including the Democratic Republic of Congo and Liberia. Global activist groups have long argued that this $7 billion a year industry has directly contributed and prolonged many of these conflicts. After years of intense advocacy from these groups, the international diamond industry has finally responded with a scheme to eradicate so-called conflict or bloodstones. But, as Brendan Sweeney reports, there remains a number of troubling questions about the effectiveness of the system.
Few commodities have as much mythical value in the United States as the diamond. In its famous and very successful ad campaign, De Beers, the world's largest diamond company, has told Americans that they should expect to spend 2 months' salary on engagement rings, and that these minerals are somehow representative of love, economic status, and vitality. In recent years, however, diamonds have been receiving a wave of bad publicity, as these stones have been linked to brutal civil wars in Sierra Leone, Angola, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Since the late 1990s, watchdog groups such as London-based Global Witness and Partnership Africa Canada have documented how diamonds illegally mined by combatants have exacerbated and prolonged these conflicts. The diamond industry has participated in this process, often knowingly purchasing stones from these countries.
You know, for so long, that lack of corporate responsibility has wreaked havoc in Africa and contributed to so many bloody conflicts.
Catherine Gilfillan is an advocate with Global Witness's diamond program.
I think the diamond industry has not been transparent, has not really had to be accountable, and has so long operated with very little rules or regulations and, you know, making huge deals with a handshake.
Seeking to control public exposure surrounding the conflict diamond issue, diamond-producing nations and the industry created the so-called Kimberley Process. Non-governmental organizations, whose work was vital in first publicizing the issue of conflict diamonds and who have worked with the diamond industry to draft the Kimberley Process, have expressed guarded optimism about the recent developments. However, Ian Smilley, research director for Partnership Africa Canada's diamond program, maintains that the system as it currently exists is full of holes.
Well, there's all kinds of ways of marking diamonds. You can mark rough diamonds and you can put laser imprints and barcodes on polished diamonds, but these things can be cut off and changed, and we're talking about millions and millions of diamonds moving in a year, so The cost would be enormous.
More importantly, as a global system, the Kimberley Process can only work if every nation involved is heavily scrutinized. Indeed, one of the most common means of smuggling conflict stones is through third-party diamond-producing states with weak state monitoring functions.
It's not only about Sierra Leone and Angola and the Congo. It's about Belgium and the United States and Israel and India and all the countries that trade in diamonds. All of these countries have joined the Kimberley Process, but the problem is there isn't any system of regular monitoring. You know, everybody's watching Sierra Leone like a hawk, but nobody's paying any attention to India or Israel or Belgium. What we're saying is that there has to be regular, independent monitoring of all national control mechanisms.
Earlier this month, the United Nations Security Council lifted sanctions on Sierra Leonean diamonds, citing progress in implementing a certification scheme in line with the Kimberley Process. However, watchdog groups maintain that until structural weaknesses in the Kimberley Process are rectified, conflict stones will continue to flow through the diamond market. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Brendan Sweeney.
I'm Amabwadi, and you are listening to Free Speech Radio News.